Place to Be Nation, welcome to the penultimate episode of myself and Tyler Kelly's countdown of our GWCW Top 100 match list. We are down to the final 20, so like I said, this will be the second to last episode, and on this one, we are going to go through matches 20 through 11. So of course, as I mentioned, my partner through this whole endeavor, Mr. Tyler Kelly. What's going on, Tyler?
Not much, Jake. I'm just impressed with your use of penultimate and ready to kick off getting to some of these, you know, with the real meat and potatoes, the heart of some of the greatest WCW matches of all time.
Yes, of course. We are getting down to what are considered, we would probably consider the all-time greats, the classics, whatever the hell you want to call them, but that's where we are at this point in the list. We have a few discrepancies, as we're going to see on here, and we'll talk about the reasons why in just a second, but we do have quite a few matches to run through on this episode, so we should probably dive right into it. So, Tyler, I believe we will start, we left off with my, I believe my number 21, so we'll start with your number 20.
My number 20 is Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan versus the Nasty Boys in a Broad Street Bullies match from Slamboree 1994. And I feel like I'm maybe a little high on this match. It finished as match number 47 on the voter composite list. But I was not the high vote, as this match actually received a number one vote. So, someone really loved this match.
Wow.
And I'm, yeah, I'm not a hockey guy, but according to the intros, the greatest enforcer of them all, Dave Schultz, is the special referee. I would take some exception to that, as I would assume that Arn Anderson would be the greatest enforcer of them all. Sullivan is replacing Max Payne in this match. Teaming with Tex, and they're in Philly, where Tex would go on to greater fame pretty soon after this match, I believe. So, of course, they brawl to start, with the announcers often calling whichever of the two were not on the camera, which actually kind of helped me to follow the match a little bit. There's lots of cheers and choking just a couple minutes in, and I believe that this would be a Jambalaya Jake slop ass brawl trademark. I'm misunderstanding exactly the definition of a slop ass brawl. You can let me know, but I believe this would fit the bill. Cactus uses
absolutely
the fire.
100%. Yeah. Yes, right. This is a slap ass brawl in every way.
Yeah, in every way, because Cactus is using a fire extinguisher as a weapon. Cactus Sullivan hits a pile driver on the ramp. Cactus brings Sags, but they misses the Cactus elbow onto the trash can. So here, I think the psychology and the limb work on this are just fantastic. Just fucking kidding. This is a crazy, chaotic brawl as Sags hits Cactus with the fan's camera. And it's just impossible to keep up with all the weapon shots and the brawling. As Tony says, it's the damnedest thing he's ever seen. Cactus hit the clothesline into the ring, which they've barely been in. Sags nails Cactus off the ramp through a table and then hits him with a light stand. Cactus is bleeding and Sags hits the top rope elbow drop onto Cactus, but he doesn't cover. Sags pushes Schultz and grabs his hockey stick to use on Cactus, but Schultz stops him and rolls with him, including pulling his shirt over his head, as they would do in a hockey brawl. Cactus hits the hockey stick and then hits Sags, and Schultz does counts maybe the fastest 1-2-3 I've ever had. And the Philly crowd seemed to like the Schultz stuff, and it seemed fine and mostly inoffensive. I thought it was a great wild brawl. And I had this one just a bit higher than the Stampede match because it was the blow-off of the feud, and I liked the brawl. And maybe just a touch better, because I think and I like Sullivan just a touch better as a brawler. So it's a mild upgrade from Max Payne. And that's why I had this one just a little bit higher than I had the other one.
Yeah, so this one I actually didn't rank, and it's not really because I think maybe the 80 matches I had you know, so far were like better necessarily. I just felt like those two, like this one and the Spring Stampede one, are so similar to me. It felt kind of strange, and it seems hypocritical because I have other instances where I have, like, as we're going to get to with the Flair Steamboats, where a lot of those kind of are, I guess, maybe similar, and I have multiple of those. But for whatever reason, these two seem so similar to me, and I kind of go the other way where I like the Spring Stampede one a bit more. I find that one, like, hits a little bit more of a manic kind of atmosphere than this one. This one at points seems a little bit more just like a pretty standard, in a good way, still a really fun and interesting and entertaining slop ass brawl. But there's something about that other one that it just reaches this level of chaos that I don't know that this one gets to. And I don't think it like ruins the match or anything, but I think if you're, for the purposes of a list like this where you kind of having to nitpick and see, you know, what's going to be included or not, I do think the, like, the fast count at the end is kind of goofy a little bit. Like, even I think Jesse points it out. I want to say Jesse, this is like towards the end of his run, but he's like, what the hell is that? It's the fastest count I've ever seen. It's kind of a funny moment in there. And the commentary is really fun, I should say. Like, at one point, like you said, Tony is like, Jesse points out that Tony's like in tears because he's just the level, the absurdity of the whole thing is just getting to him, which is really entertaining. But like, to compare it to the finish of the other, the Max Payne match, I agree with you. I like Sullivan better than Max Payne, but I just think, like, it's not a credit to Max Payne, the other match. I think it's a credit to all the other guys. And I kind of like the finish of the other match a bit better because it's just so wild and abrupt the way it happens. Like, he just gets smacked with that shovel like we talked about. And that's just such an interesting finish to me. So if I were to say, if I was just purely ranking this on, you know, quality of the matches, this one would have probably made my list somewhere maybe lower than the other one. But for 100 spots, I guess I was just thinking maybe I wasn't going to include both of them. So it's not necessarily a dig on the match itself. It's more just for some, whatever reason, I kind of felt like I was going to pick one or the other to include on my list. But they're both pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, I can understand that logic. Move on to your number 20.
Yeah, so my number 20 will be the Rock and Roll Express versus the Russians from July 13th of 1985. So this one is kind of cool. And so you had this one at 32, Tyler. So you and I, we're in the same realm. I think with this, we're only about 10 spots away from each other, which is generally in the same ballpark as far as the in the grand scheme of the list. But I really like this matchup. I think I picked another Rock and Rolls versus Russians match earlier. I think it was a cage match we had talked about before. And I think I like this one a good bit better because this one, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the Rock and Roll Express's their debut in Jim Crocker Promotions, right? They had been in other, I'm assuming like maybe Mid-South or something like that before this.
That's correct.
Yeah, and so even
their debut in
Yeah, and so even with them making their debut, they obviously had the notoriety from where they had worked before because the crowd is completely into them. Of course, they're facing the Russians, so it's going to be, you know, they're going to have a lot of, you know, the crowd's going to be behind them anyway. But they're just, like, you would think they would have been there because they're already getting the rock and roll chance throughout the entire match. The crowd's super hot for them. And it's just really good speed versus power is established right from the get-go. And I think they work that dynamic really well. I think Ivan particularly makes them look really good in the way he allows them to use their speed to kind of get over on them at points. I think it's really good. And they kind of do the formula tag stuff that, of course, the Rock and Roll Express are known for. And I think it just works really well in this. Like, the atmosphere of this feels really big. It just feels like a big match to put them against the champs in their debut match and, you know, to establish them. And then you get the great moment of them winning at the end is really awesome. Like I said, it feels big. It's their debut. It's like they obviously like wanted to push them pretty hard to have them come in their first match, win the titles against the Russians, against a team that you could argue they're overmatched for. Overmatched against, I should say. And the finish is really slick. Like, they do the it's really cool because you kind of just think in the end they're gonna finally, you know, succumb to the overwhelming power of the Russians, but they manage to use their kind of craftiness. It's like the story of the match comes to fruition in the conclusion, in that they kind of like I think it's Ricky gets the kind of gets a roll up, and then Robert slides in and grabs I forget who pins who, but he grabs whoever's legs and stops them from breaking up the pin while Ricky gets the roll up. So it's just an awesome way to debut them. And I know it's not, you know, this is supposed to be a little bit more about the match as a whole, but I think it's hard to separate all this, that this is their debut, and it just completely establishes who they are. These like speedy, scrappy baby faces, and to go against these power guys and kind of just grind out this win after they got an ass kicking throughout the whole match. And just they do their signature sort of that we've talked about, as we've mentioned the Rock and Rolls quite a bit on our list so far for obvious reasons, but the way they're able to work in the hope spots. And I think it's expertly done in this match, like it is in most of their matches. But I just think it's really well done in this one, how they just and I think it's Robert in this one that plays the face in peril more, which is kind of interesting. But just all their hope spots are really well done. They never allow you to kind of lose interest in the match, because you never feel like they're out of it. You never get to this point where you're like, oh, well, I guess they're just going to get beat down for 10 minutes, because they kind of do, but then they also kind of, you know, they're always fighting back, and it just keeps you invested and gets you behind them. But it's awesome. It's a great win. It's a big moment. It's just cool that that's the way that they got to come in and get established. So it's a really cool moment and a great match.
Yeah, Jake, I agree completely. Like you mentioned, I think I had this at 32. It finished as match 37 on the voter list. The Rock and Roll Express's debut, and according to David Crockett, they debut in the main event of all time. So, like the wordsmith. And I think you're right. They had been in some other in the South, and I think they were in Memphis too. And one thing I kind of liked about this is that it felt like it had kind of the same structure, but like as like beginning matches, it kind of had the shine that the Rock and Rolls always get. And then it had the heat segment where Ricky Morton's playing Ricky Morton number one, so you know, which makes sense. But he makes the hot tag to Robert pretty quickly, and then they kind of get a second shine where they work on Ivan's leg, and they do their somersault, and then they punch Khrushchev in the corner, and then they try to do it again, but Khrushchev jumps off the apron, so they, like, he thought he'd got one up on them, so then they just hit Ivan, and when Khrushchev gets back up, again, it's kind of like almost the second shine, and then, like you mentioned, he becomes the face in peril, and the longer face in peril, I didn't put a stopwatch on it, but it definitely was kind of the real face in peril, shoulder being kind of worked over. And, you know, I think that Robert Gibson does it in the course. Morton's kind of the best ever at it, but Gibson was really good at it. And I kind of feel like in an alternate universe, Robert Gibson could be the face in peril playing Ricky Morton more regularly if he wasn't teaming with Ricky Morton and to make a tag to someone else. I had David Crockett struck me out, of course, and then I really like the finish where he finally makes a hot tag to Ricky, and he kind of breaks down, and I think Ricky jumps on one on the Ivan's back maybe and does a victory roll, and like you said, Robert, you know, grabs the other one legs, and it's just, you know, the heat's off the charts. Crowd lost their mind, and David Crockett needs to smoke after that one, I think. So, yeah, it's a great match. All right.
Mm-hmm.
That would take number 19, which is Tully Blanchard versus 5-3. So this match is one there's a little story about this. Doing my research, I my TV match was going through them, and somehow I missed this match upon my, you know, the chronological, that is, people were kind of starting to talk about their ballots and what matches might make it. I started to hear some chatter about this. I thought, well, I don't remember that match at all. So I'm going to see if I can, you know, find it and take another look at it. And I don't know if, like, I tried to watch it and the file just didn't work or whatever, and then I forgot about it, or if I skipped over it because it was a longer match, but I hadn't watched it, and then, like, shortly before I turned in my ballot, I did, and, like, oh, wow, holy shit, I'm glad I didn't. That was kind of a disaster averted there. This match finished number 83 on the voter composite list. And for the national it's a big match, probably just because it's a marquee match on free TV. They interview Ric Flair, and he calls Tully the greatest national title holder, and then addresses his feud with Ricky Matt. He has an injured hand, and Tully and JJ make him take off the tape before the match, so the hand injury becomes the story of the match. Dusty's on commentary with David Crockett and Tony, and they're all in over this hand angle really strong. This match just starts with this really intense lockup. Like, in one, Starvin pushes Tully all the way into the corner, and it just kind of keeps going and climbs up the ropes, and it looks like he bites Tully's head. So, and again, Starvin can't use the hand of stone, so he just uses a break any hold that Tully gets in, and he headbutts Tully until he bleeds. And he gets a sleeper, and Dusty says, that dog will hunt, so you know we're getting into business here. Darwin's throwing the hand just great. He's not even using it. Like, when he hooks the legs, he doesn't even have to hook the legs on cover, so he can't throw the hand. And the announcers are all putting that over. And David Crockett's throwing it like Darwin's arm's going to fall off at any time. So, and both Tully and Darwin are just really doing a wonderful job of conveying the intensity and the drama. And the announcers are blatantly cheering for Garvin. Dream's telling him to tie him up like a pretzel. Tully legs off. He's throwing his leg. And Dusty says to break it off. Garvin's using a spinning kill hold before Tully goes to the app. And Garvin just kind of keeps working the leg. Tully just keeps buying time. He's running out of the ring, you know. Just trying to stall like he'll do. Crowd solidly behind Garvin. In later feuds, that may not be the case, but they're sure behind him here. Garvin rakes the back, and Dusty says, knife tracks across your back. And I don't want to know how he came up with that or what story he might have about that. So leave that one to the dream. At one point, they work over the arm with JJ Chu, and then Tully really works over the hand. I mean, he's really going after it. And I think Tully's facial expression is great. He always looks like a weasel. He's big and he's cowardly when he's bitten off, and it's just part of it. Not like some dramatic reaction shot, but I think that's what makes him so great. The ending is Tommy gets bumped, and JJ hands Tully a roll of quarters, and Dusty leaves commentary and takes Garvin. So it's almost, and Garvin wins it, and he hits the punch, and he knocks Tully out, and he gets the pin, and then JJ points out that the tape is on the fist, and Young disqualifies Garvin. Now, across the wrestler, all over the ring, and Tommy says, all I saw was this man with tape on his hand, so he's disqualified. So, anyway, the story was behind the hand and the drama and the intensity that they sold out. I'm glad narrowly averted that is not watching it for it to make my list.
Yeah, unfortunately for me, I think the reason it didn't make my list is because when I originally did it, this is just one that kind of slipped through the cracks on me that I didn't watch, that I think is unfortunately what happened to some of these TV matches, like your worldwide matches and that sort of thing. I mean, I have some of them that we're going to talk about as we continue on, but I think it was just an unfortunate thing for me, just a matter of stuff getting left off because I didn't get a chance to see it, because this is a pretty awesome match, and these are two awesome guys that are definitely on my list in other places, but just for whatever reason, this match kind of just slipped through the cracks on me. But anyway, so I guess we'll go on to my number 19, which this one is a bit, I guess you could say a bit obscure, but I'm glad for whatever reason I chose to watch it, because of the next two matches, I kind of stacked these two on my list, were kind of like maybe my favorite discovery of doing this entire project. And I've kind of watched some Piper before in this era in NWA and Mid-Atlantic and that sort of thing in JCP, and you know, enjoyed it a good bit, but I'd never seen like all of his matches. And you know, Piper's a guy who I think sometimes is known as being like an all-time great, but maybe not always considered the greatest like wrestler in the world. And I think it's because, you know, for a lot of us, it's, you know, the most notable point of his career is from 85 onward, like his WWF run. And then I guess later on in WCW, where, you know, he's kind of in his twilight years of actually being an in-ring wrestler. But man, this stuff. So to get to the actual match. So my number 19 is Jack Briscoe versus Roddy Piper from Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, which is just TV, July 7th, 1982. And so this is for, I cannot remember what title. It's whatever title Jack Briscoe has. It's so hard to remember all these titles, especially like these early 80s, like, because it's like going to be like the Mid-Atlantic American semi-heavyweight champion, you know, whatever. It's I forget what title it's for, but it's for a title.
I think it was the Mid-Atlantic title.
Yes. So the Mid-Atlantic title. But anyway, it's for the title, and it's for it's also for $10,000. I think the story is something about like Jack Briscoe was willing to pay $10,000 to have Piper face him or whatever. And so he's sort of the face in this and Piper's the heel. But man, this is just like a war. Just first of all, the punches in this are just great. And every one that they hit, like never – they never throw a single punch in this match to me that doesn't seem important or doesn't matter to the match. Like nothing seems like just like, well, we're just killing some time with strikes. Like every punch from both guys just kind of looks like they're laying it in, and it's a real part of the match. Like it's an actual move, not just like a strike. And it's awesome. Just a killer struggle with the headlock. Like this whole match is just such a nice struggle between them. Like I said, fighting the whole first portion of the match is them fighting out of a headlock, and it's not boring at all. It's like, they're really selling. They're really selling the struggle of it. It all just feels like a fight. Like I said, it's not a match that you really go spot for spot for, because a lot of it is just them. Like I would say 50% of the match is the headlock in the beginning, and then the sleeper hold exchange later in the match where Piper gets the sleeper hold for a while. Briscoe tries to get out of it. He locks it back in, and then he reverses it, and then Briscoe gets his own sleeper hold. So the whole first part is a headlock, and then a lot of the latter part of the match is based around a sleeper hold, and almost everything else in the match is pretty much just strikes of different forms, like just punches mainly, and, you know, some, you know, forearms and that kind of thing, but not a ton of, like, moves, I would say. But it just has this level of intensity. It's just a great fight. Like, and by the end of it, both of them, they're just full of sweat. They're bleeding. They both look completely spent until finally Piper, out of desperation, pulls out the roll of coins. And as the ref's kind of distracted, he cracks him with the roll of coins to get the cheap win. And even the post-match is really awesome. As soon as he wins, he grabs the belt. He's sitting on the outside. And I love the little detail of, like, actually showing us, like, the torn-up roll of coins. So to truly show us that, like, they didn't just go with the, you know, oh, well, it was just a foreign object or whatever. He said it was coins, and you see the coins all over the ring. You see the torn up, like, little cardboard, like, coin roll thing. And Piper's just outside with the title, and they ask him, like, hey, did you, like, Bob Cobb's like, did you just use some coins? And he goes, no, no, the fans threw that in there. The fans threw it in there. And he, like, he almost threatens him to make him say, he's like, you saw the fans throw it, right? And he goes, oh, yeah, the fans threw it, because he just doesn't want Piper to go after him. Because Piper's like a maniac, but it's just, man, just everything about this. Like, it's just two guys just beating the piss out of each other. They sell the exhaustion so well by the end. You really feel like both of these guys have just been beating the hell out of each other. Like I said, it's just a testament to this match that the most of it is just like some variation of a headlock or a sleeper and then just kind of strikes. And the fact that it's this awesome, it's just awesome. I don't know. I love this match so much. I'll talk about the next one, too, because to me, they kind of go hand in hand. And the next one on my list is almost a better version of this match. But I thought this was fantastic. This was one of my favorite discoveries of doing the whole project.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think this was one of the bigger discoveries of the project because, you know, Chad talked about this on Carolina Dreamin', and I, you know, was not aware of it. And I, from what I kind of gathered, a lot of people weren't too aware of it. This match finished at number 118. You were the high vote on this, but it's, you know, it's clearly a great match. And I liked it. It was kind of the whole story, right? The really great angle and promo from Piper, and he's going to only face for a title, I think. But it was Briscoe's title in the first place. He stole it from him, if I was understanding everything correctly. He'd only do that if Briscoe puts up the $10,000. And they did this big thing that it was all those cover the difference. And you know, Piper's just going, he's calling, was it Cottle? He's like, you're scum, because there was not $10,000 in there. You're scum. You know, he's counting it. Just tremendous stuff. So,
yeah.
And I felt like it was kind of a mix of the old school and, I mean, Jack Briscoe's just a tremendous, tremendous wrestler. You know, kind of towards the end of his run, but you know, he's that great. To me, he's one of the best of that old school style. And then Piper just gets these random spurts of manic energy, but they work together really well. And I had some of the same things, Piper showing rage, and he knocks the piss out of Briscoe. And I'm glad Piper's promo at the end where he says, none of the people do that money in the ring. But I hit it out, Piper promo. So it didn't make my list, but I definitely think this was in that. It was one of the last cuts in consideration. You know, it's somewhere in that 4-star range, and I wouldn't argue with anyone that said that. I mean, I consider that as the total package, but I wouldn't argue with anyone that had it higher. So. All right. That brings us to my number 18 then. My number 18 is The Enforcers versus Dustin Rhodes and Ricky Steamboat from Clash of the Champions 17. This match finished as number 19 on the voter composite list, and Dustin needed a partner after Larry Zbyszko crunched Barry's hand at Halloween Havoc in a car door, which was, you know, just an awesome angle. And so he has a mystery partner, and the mystery partner just lives up to the hype. And I like that it's kind of a nod to when Steamboat was Eddie Gilbert's partner in 1989, and that's what we've already talked about, but was good enough to make both of our lists. Steamboat starts with just a great flurry, and Arn and Larry both kind of bail to the outside, and Arn does the famous "he's just a man" line. He's calming himself down. He's, you know, he's pumping himself back up, I guess. He's just a man. He's just a man. So he's really putting Steamboat over as a threat, and I just love that. The Enforcers, they stooge and sell, like both guys really do. The faces show great fire, and eventually the heels take over on Steamboat after he chased Larry out, and he didn't see the, you know, the blind tag on, and Arn attacks him from behind, and that's how they took over. And then right after that, they do another great blind tag where Steamboat gets a sunset flip. And he's got a pin, but then they attack him from behind, break up the pin. Arn works Steamboat's back with a bear hug, and then Steamboat tries a body scissors, but Arn reverses to a Boston Crab in a really nice spot, I thought. Then Larry comes in, does the same. He's got the Boston as well. Steamboat makes a tag, but the ref doesn't see it, and the crab really biting on it this time. Then he makes the real hot tag to Dustin. He comes in, he's just a house of fire. And I think Dustin is kind of an underrated tag team wrestler because he can play both parts really well. And then he tags in Steamboat, so all four are kind of in, and Steamboat hits a crossbody on Arn. Destin just kind of sprints across the ring to prevent Larry from breaking up the pin. So Destin and Steamboat win the titles. Ricky is reintroduced as a main event player, and they're kind of setting up this alliance of babyfaces that would eventually battle the Dangerous Alliance, even though the Dangerous Alliance hasn't yet been formed, I don't believe. But it's all sort of starting to take shape for what would become that great 1992 year that we've talked about. So, I mean, I think this match just had great shine. It had a great face in peril. And it had a great comeback. So it's just kind of what I'm looking for in a tag team match. So.
Yeah, this was a big whiff by me, Tyler. I did not rank this one even though I know this match. I really love this match. And actually, the Enforcers are kind of low-key, like a hidden gem team for me. Like, I really love the Enforcers as a team, even though it's a very short run. But, like, Arn and Larry, like, that whole little run they have is so fantastic. They just, like, every match, they're just, like, dissecting guys. And it's really cool to have this moment, too, where, you know, because I want to say this is where they've kind of been on their little run, Arn and Larry, and they've kind of been, you know, picking people off, and then here comes Steamboat, you know, to come in and give them their comeuppance. And I love that moment when Steamboat comes out. It's so great. But yeah, this is an awesome match. It's just I'll call it a logistical error on my part as to why it wasn't ranked, because I really do love this match. It's one that I really enjoy. For I don't know how I ended up not putting it on here.
Well, I wasn't kind of curious about that, because I have heard you say in the course of our podcast how you really enjoy the Enforcers as a tag team. I thought, well,
yeah, okay. And this is probably like their marquee. And this is like their marquee. Yeah, this is like their marquee match. The fuck am I doing? Yeah, just, you know, playing the other 100 matches. It's hard for my brain, I guess. But anyway, I'm glad at least you gave it a lot of credit by having your top 20, because it certainly, who knows where I would have ranked it, but it easily would have been in my top 50, no doubt, and probably would have been around here. But I guess I'll try not to rag on myself too much and just keep on chugging along here. So I will now go on to my number 18. And so, like I said, it kind of goes hand in hand with my number 19, because there's another Piper Mid-Atlantic match. And so this is against Greg Valentine, and this is from 7983, some Mid-Atlantic TV program, I think. But I don't know if it was the actual, like, Mid-Atlantic studio show, because this is not a studio match. Like the Briscoe match we were just talking about was. This one is actually in an arena. I'm not really sure where, but this is in front of a full crowd. And the crowd is a huge part of this. The crowd is electric throughout this entire match. And it's funny, because we just talked about the Briscoe match. So this is a year later, essentially. And Piper is now the face and Valentine is the heel. And the whole feud here, I don't know about the whole feud, but obviously the big blow off would come at Starrcade, which we're going to talk about in just a second, with the dog collar match. So this is kind of building up to that. And I don't know the whole thing, because I can't say I've watched all the TV. I'm like an expert in the feud. But I know part of this, and it comes through in the match, is that I want to say, like, Valentine hurt Piper's ear or something, or injured his ear at some point. And so Piper, it's basically like Valentine is trying to work over the ear because he knows it's Piper's weak spot. But then Piper is trying to pretty much rip off Greg Valentine's ear as a, like, an act of revenge, like an ear for an ear sort of thing. And so the entire match is super hot. It's super heated. Like, there's a lot of hatred throughout this match, and they really channel it. Like I said, it's definitely, you could see how they were getting to the dog collar match. If you watch this one, you could see how they ended up where they did for Starrcade. But you get a super hot start from Piper. He's just clubbing the piss out of him. And just like I said in the last match with Briscoe, the strikes in this match are just fantastic. Like, whether it's Piper just hitting him, Valentine hitting the forearms and stuff, they're just clubbing the shit out of each other in this match. And it looks fantastic. And every time Piper gets over on him, it's like you said, he has these like kind of manic bursts of energy, but especially here when he's the face, because every time he gets it, the crowd just goes out of their mind in this. Like, it's like a lot of the same things I was talking about with the Briscoe match, but this match just has a little bit of extra juice to it, because I feel like the feud is just a little hotter. The crowd's hotter. You could feel the hatred a lot more through this, where you could feel it in the Briscoe match, but this one is just kind of on another level. Like, you have at one point Piper's like biting his ear. He's like punching Valentine in the ear. the Valentine's ripping at his ear. So it's like, like the ear cell, like what a brutal limb. Like, I don't really, it's not really a limb, but what a brutal like body part to focus on. Like in this grudge match, is like for each guy to be going after their ear. It's so unique, and like it's like such savagery from both guys. Like I'm trying to think, like it's probably some of the best like strike exchanges I've ever seen in any match, if I'm being honest. Hopefully it's not hyperbolic, but I really think it is. Like it's so good. Like they go on the outside, the brawling on the outside is great. Like nothing ever seems like contrived either. Like it all seems kind of natural. Like, they just spill out onto the floor. It's not like, well, we work our way onto the floor, now we're fighting outside. Like they just fall outside and they're just like on the cement punching each other in the face. Like I said, and then finally the finish, which in the same way I popped for the for Funk with the plastic bag, this is like that but even to another level. In that, so this match basically ends with so they have those little ropes in this time period that they would kind of put, because they didn't have like true barricades for the crowd. They would kind of have that little blue, like one of the most the barricades we know today to separate the crowd from the ring. And so they would kind of play, I guess, this little like rope thing that would go along with it. And so at the end of the match, it's like Piper just pretty much snaps and he grabs that rope and like starts choking Valentine with it, to the point that they have to stop the match. And even after the match stops, he like is legitimately choking him, like trying to murder him. Like he ties it up and like wraps it completely around his neck. Valentine is like foaming at the mouth, and they have to like clear the locker room to try and get Piper off of him, because it's pretty much like insinuated that Piper would have probably tried to murder him right here, like just choked him to death. It's so brutal. It's awesome. You just feel the hatred between both guys, especially Piper wanting to get back at Valentine and go after his ear. The ear stuff is just fantastic. To make that part of the psychology of the match is just cool and unique and brutal. It's just an excellent war. You know, the more we talk about this, and I think it's something we're going to talk about, especially as we get into this home stretch here, is that, you know, we've been talking a lot of things like with the tag matches, how that's such a part of the DNA of like NWA, WCW. And I think this too, this sort of match, like, you know, this, we talked about the Cactus Jack and the Nasty Boys brawls. We've talked a lot, and we have some very famous ones still to come. But just, I think this is another type of match that is just like the bread and butter of, you know, what I think, what you think of when you think of like WCW and NWA. It's these brutal kind of wars that even when it's not really like, and the ability to do this even in a match like this, where it's not even like weapons or anything like that, it's just two guys just punching the shit out of each other and just feeling like they hate each other and they legit want to kill each other, is a really awesome thing they put across. And I think it's just as big, it's another one of those things that they kind of hang their hat on through these, you know, something like a through line you could probably find through both of our lists is these types of matches. And this one was just, it was another level between the crowd, Piper's insanity, Valentine bringing it to like just trying to fight off this insane maniac Piper who's trying to kill him basically. It's just, it's all fantastic stuff. And again, this early Piper stuff is just, man, if you feel like you haven't seen enough like great Roddy Piper matches, this early 80s stuff is just, it's like nothing but hits from him.
Oh, absolutely. This is one of those matches, and we'll talk about some others, and some others even involving these same two people, where they just convey this intensity. And it's an art that it's hard to explain. You have to watch it. And you can tell that Piper just glares hatred sometimes. That this year's psychology, you did a good job explaining that. Some of the history, because it really kind of started even before this match, but it continues on. And it's just, it's so brutal. I had it, I think 73, I had it in my 70s. And I think that's just because, it was a kind of a hidden, I think it was on Hidden Gems is how I even found it. So it was somewhat obscure, but I kind of blew it with that one. Really, I just had this higher, just based on all the other matches that I love. So I am happy that it did get the attention that it deserves. And I think people either discovered it or gave it some credit. this match finished at number 64 on our list. So I think that speaks well to the voters. And, you know, you talked about that finish. That was something else. I mean, it. Mm-hmm. And so just as far as some of my process when I'm rewatching some of these matches that were on TV or, you know, that I'll download them and I'll watch them when I drop my daughter off for dance class. So she's in there in dance class and I'm sitting here watching Roddy Piper and I'm thinking he's going to murder someone. And they're in there. They're leotards, and I'm watching Piper. Not only does he choke Valentine with the rope, and it's a rope. I mean, it's like twine, but a little more sturdy, and he's sawing it across his throat. My God, that had to hurt. And yeah, it just, and how Valentine sold that, I'm not sure, unless he really was half dying. I mean, it's just incredible. So yeah,
like choke, strangle would probably be the better word, maybe.
Yeah. Just really, really brutal stuff. So that will, spoiler alert, we will talk about these people again yet tonight on this very night. Okay. But for now, we will go to my number, where are we at? 17, which is Midnight Express versus the Fantastics from Worldwide on 5/14/88. Give me just a second to find that on my sheet. But this was the debut of the Fantastics. I believe. Oh, wait. No. I'm sorry. That was the one we talked about earlier. So this would be after their clash match. So this match finished at number 55 on the voter composite list. And it is just straight fire, constant action. This is my highest Midnight Fantastic match, which is saying something because I've had a couple others already on this list. The Fantastics just have this incredible shine that we've talked about before, Jake. And the Midnights are so good at stooging and making opponents look great until they take over. One sequence in the shine sees Tommy take a backdrop, flip on over, and land on his feet. And then hit a couple drop kicks, and then the Fargo strap. Later, Stan goes up to the top rope to try to come off onto Rogers, but Fulton shakes the ropes from across the ring, and Stan crouches himself, and then Fulton just kind of lays on the ropes like he's laying on the couch. And so then when the ref comes over and admonishes him for that, he runs into the ring, stepping on Bobby Eaton on the way in, pointing out Stan tried to cheat, and then goes back and steps on Bobby on the way back out. And that's kind of a comedy spot, but I thought that was really good. You know, that was a nice one, I thought. They just have great timing on so many spots. Like Stan tries to slingshot into the ring, and Fulton just hits him out of the air with a punch. And Rogers hits Eaton with a dropkick on the concrete, which really should hurt Rogers worse, but it looked good. And Fulton hits a Rana just as they're going to a commercial break. Come back in. Tommy tries to head scissors on Bobby, but Stan interferes and kind of slams his neck across the rope and the spot that looked really good. And the Midnights just take over just like that. So the announcers, which is Tony and I have a subdued David Crockett. So I wondered if he'd been listening to Hot Tokes on the Jenny position earlier. So there's a thumbs up, cheek pop there on that plug. And I think that Jenny and David Crockett sitting around and enjoying some of her hot tokes would just be, like, that's a show I'd want to watch. I want to listen to that podcast. I want to watch that YouTube, whatever. So, anyway, I got sidetracked. But the announcers say that the pace slows with the Midnight Control, which I think would be bullshit, but it kind of puts the faces over and gets more heat on the heels. Tommy's playing the face in peril number one, but he eventually makes a hot tag to Fulton. But the Midnights just almost immediately send him outside to the railing to retain control. And their offense just looks great, as it always does. Eaton hits a top rope elbow. And this does test my theory, Jake, but the theory does hold up if that is not the finish, though Cornette thought it was. And honestly, I thought that the ref counted three. It was that close. I mean, they were right on it. Fulton's also bleeding, and the ref is teasing stopping the match. But Fulton crawls, and he begs him not to. Cornette's pitching to the ref, while all the while, Tommy's perched on the top rope on the other turnbuckle. He gets a missile drop kick, and Eaton falls over Fulton just as the ref recovers, count three. The timing on that was just outstanding. It didn't look staged at all. It was just perfect. It sort of, when I talk through it, it kind of sounds like it could look staged, but it is, they pretty much nailed it. Tony and David are just stammering over the match and the finish. Chattanooga crowd is going nuts for the fantastic win, and that makes it seem like a big deal. I believe this was for the U.S. tag title, so they win that. And, you know, I just think this is just one of the best tag team matches you can get. So it's, I think I have one tag match higher on my list. But this really might be, you know, the best one they ever had. I mean, I wouldn't argue with that too much.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you in that. If I didn't have it as the best tag match on my whole list, I think it's the best of this sort of style, like the Fantastic Midnight Express, like just think incredible. Like you've said it quite a few times while you're talking about it, the timing of what they do. And you made a good point too, because exactly how I would describe it too, in that they do these spots where it's like the way that they don't show you the strings, like the way they do these would have to be like extremely well planned out spots or well executed spots. Like they could so easily, if they didn't do them so well and so smooth, could come off as kind of looking sort of too set up and kind of take you out of it. But they just do them so flawlessly and integrate them into the match so well. It's like a preternatural talent these guys have. Like they're just such naturals at everything. Like they just make it all look so easy. Like the spot, and you may have mentioned this one, so I'm sorry if you did, but like the one that really stood out to me in this match was there's a point where they like drop kick Bobby Fulton outside the ring, and they like immediately, it's like I forget who drop kicks him, but then I think it's Bobby Eaton drop kicks him outside the ring, and then Stan is waiting outside and just immediately hangs him on the barricade, like drops almost like almost stun guns him on the barricade. Like, and it just happens on like a flash. It's just amazing. Like the teamwork from both teams, like you said, the shine is always from the Fantastics. They just come in so hot. And then when the Midnight Express finally get their upper hand, like they're really awesome and of just working them over, and it just flows so well. It's just, like you said, the thing that comes to me is just the timing of all of it is just so flawlessly executed. It's just amazing to watch, honestly, but it's really awesome. I wasn't quite as high as you, but I went 38, so still top 40 for me. It's just awesome stuff. Just, you know, like any of these teams, and I like the whole, I want to say this one was one, I don't know if this one took the entire episode, but I think quite a lot of these like worldwide matches and stuff that we're talking about, a lot of these kind of got which I think kind of adds to the kind of the atmosphere of the match when you know it's one of these matches that's going to take up the entire episode of TV, and they kind of tell you like this is I think maybe on the, is this the one where they say like, well, we have some other stuff playing in case we need it, but we're gonna let this one go as long as we can, like pretty much telling you it's going to last the entire episode. But I think this was that sort of match. Like I want to say this one was about 30 minutes, and with everything involved, it was pretty much the entire episode of Worldwide, which I think is a cool like kind of a cool dynamic to just have a great match like this take up the whole episode. I think it kind of adds to the feel of it. It makes it feel bigger.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that's a great point that the timing of these guys, of these teams, it takes such cooperation and coordination, but it never looks fake. It never looks like yes. They're working together. It's just incredible. And not yeah. Just incredible. It's much better than that.
Correct. So, but with that, we will head on to my number, I believe this will be my number 17, which is the War Game match from 1991, which we will get to in just a couple minutes, because you have it a bit higher than me.
I have it a bit higher, but we will talk about it on this very night. So, we can go on to my number 16, which is Ric Flair versus Ricky Morton for the NWA world title in a cage match at Great American Bash 1986 from Charlotte. So this match finished as number 26 on the voter composite voting. And it starts out with Flair entering the stadium in an effing helicopter and walking the red carpet to the cage. Right there, I was like, that match makes my list right now. If they'd have walked to the cage and walked right out after Flair came in the stadium on a helicopter, I think it makes my list. So this match is kind of a continuation of the storyline where the Horseman rub Ricky's nose into concrete. So he wears a covering from this point on. And I'll give a shout out to Pro Wrestling Love, and Marty Sleaze was doing his list reveal. That was the first section of the Pro Wrestling Love. And I normally wouldn't talk about anyone else's list, but since he did a podcast on it, I think I can. And this was his number one. And he had this whole theory that everything Ric Flair does revolves around sex, and that was the basis of this feud. And it's, you need to listen to that episode because Marty lays it all out and it's tremendous. And I believe that would be episode 5 of Pro Wrestling Love, because I listened to it and he says that if it's an increment of 5, it'll be the top matches of whatever particular style he's talking about. So Ricky, of course, shows good babyface fire, and he rubs Flair's face in the mat early on. Flair shows his ass for his contract, and that's not a figure of speech. That's, of course, literal, because it's Ric Flair. Ricky works over Flair's nose, and at one point he's, like, grabbing his nose and hauling him by his nose, and I actually grabbed my nose there. It probably doesn't come across that well on an audio format, but anyway, Flair's taking off, and when Flair gets back in control, he removes Ricky's nose guard and he rams him into the cage multiple times, and Ricky's bleeding about 10 minutes in. Flair does his woo, and the audience just kind of responds involuntarily. It's like Pavlov's dog. You just can't help yourself. If Ric Flair says woo, then the crowd says woo. That's just how it goes. Then he drops the knee and he does these pelvic thrusts to the audience. So I don't believe that he was I don't believe he did that as a term of endearment. I'll go with Ric Flair. Maybe he did. I don't know. So he's selling and bleeding as he does. Flair's yelling and taunting and working him over on the cage. Ricky's got this glorious, gross crimson mask, and Flair does a mocking rock and roll chant and then gets a figure four. Ricky does his usual great sell job, and he just keeps fighting while Flair's just a cocksucker, and the crowd just keeps getting more and more behind Ricky as he rams Flair into the cage. And now Flair's bleeding too. And, Ricky's not going to take any stuff from him, so he says, come on, world champion, show me what you got. And that's about 20 minutes in. And Flair's just, he's kind of, I don't even know how to describe it. He's panting and selling it. And like, he's very verbal. So you hear the, oh God, and just, he's kind of selling it, the fatigue, and that he's kind of taking a beating. So Flair drops Ricky on the top rope, crotch first, and then he wins with his feet on the ropes. So kind of, again, maybe that goes back to Marty's theory. He drops him crotch first, and that was the finish. Both guys are just a bloody mess with their blonde hair turning red. And what I really love about this match is that my rational mind knows there's no way that Ricky Morton would be NWA champion, but you believe he can do it, and you want him to do it, and it's just such a testament to how both guys can tell a story. And, like, there weren't a lot of fancy moves. It's just great match structure, great story, great timing. And those are things that I appreciate more, maybe the more wrestling I watch, maybe the older I get. And I think it comes through a lot in this project, especially. Like, this 80s JCT into the early days of WCW, they were really good at that type of thing, I think.
Yeah, this was another victim of just me not watching this, and when I was putting together my list, which I think maybe I would have researched it more and maybe put a bit more into the research, I would have caught it maybe. I think maybe because it isn't, you know, and maybe I'm wrong in saying this, like a huge feud, like you said, or maybe that it maybe doesn't get quite the notoriety because it does kind of seem like, and now you correct me if I'm wrong, was this kind of like a, kind of they threw, just kind of threw this out there? Like, was Ricky Morton and Ric Flair much of a feud? I feel like I don't, I'm not very familiar with it as a feud.
Sort of. The Horsemen had a good feud with the Rock and Roll Express where the Horsemen attacked Ricky. Flair cut a promo, and I'm not going to get the details of this quite right. I'm sure there's going to be somebody listening, and I'll forget something. But basically, Flair was a little bit jealous because Ricky Morton was getting cheers from the female audience as well. But Flair pointed out, and probably rightly so, that they were of a younger demographic. So he, I believe he actually brought a training bra out to Morton during one of the promos. And so that's kind of how it started. That was part of it. And eventually the Horsemen attacked Morton and rubbed his nose into the concrete. So that plays into a few of the matches with the Rock and Rolls and the Andersons that we see in 86 as well. So I feel like this was kind of a good way to like have not be one of your top matches or top feuds of the year, but kind of a good way to get you from, you know, grid. Well, I guess this was before Great American Bash was a pay-per-view, as kind of a tour, but to have kind of a side where you'd have your main event feud, and you know that would culminate at Starrcade or whatever. So I believe, and obviously get a
great match out of it too.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And this was kind of first unearthed, I believe, on I think it's Ric Flair and the Four Horsemen DVD. I should know that for sure because that's how I watched it. But I believe that's where it was, and there's no commentary on it, which almost makes it better, especially with these guys. And Flair, like I say, he can be pretty verbal when he wants to be. Yeah. So,
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. I'm familiar. But yeah, for whatever reason, it just kind of, it slipped through for me. I ended up watching it, you know, 50 lashes. But as we continue on, as I'm looking at my, as I have the spreadsheet pulled up, I see his name many times, and he's been on my list many times before. So plenty of Flair to come, and he will be in my next match because my number 16 and your number 38 would be the first of what we're going to get to, Flair versus Steamboat matches. So this is actually going to be the Boogie Jams match from March of 84. So this is, of course, famously an hour-long match. And so this one, obviously, I'm not going to sit here and go through everything. I don't think you've ever saw it, Tyler, because it is an hour-long match. But the thing about this one, and, you know, it is very long, and I think for a lot of people that is sort of a detriment. I think to me it hurts it a bit, maybe not like as much as others. I know there's some people who don't really enjoy it because they just think it's a little bit too long and dragged out. And I do think, you know, there are points it drags. Nothing does it, like everything makes sense in it. I do think there is a bit in this match where they kind of go through, I don't want to say go through the motions because I feel like that's kind of not giving enough credit, but they kind of like are going through the paces, you know, and building to things. And then kind of like the last 15 minutes, it almost goes into this like overdrive mode. And maybe there's a little bit of a disconnect between those two parts of the match. Like, I would say probably the first 3/4 of the match and the last quarter of it kind of don't necessarily go together because the first part is so kind of slow and methodical, sort of in a good way. And then it just kind of, I don't know, something about it. If I'm nitpicking, because I guess when you're doing these, you almost have to say, what is it about this one that puts it behind some of the other ones that, you know, I'm going to have ranked higher and you probably will too. And so I think maybe the hour is part of it. I mean, it is a really awesome match. Like I said, I really like the first portion of this match. It's like them just kind of going through, you know, Steamboat kind of frustrating Flair. It goes into a lot of Flair's normal paces, but it's just when he's working with Steamboat, it just kind of amps it up even more. you know, like they're going through the paces. Steamboat's kind of working the headlocks, working the kind of the neck in the back area, and Flair's getting kind of frustrated with him. And then finally Flair gets, you know, starts doing his normal desperation, goes after him, but it kind of just builds really well. I do think part of it may be that it's not as good as, or maybe I don't have it ranked higher as some of the other Flair Steamboat stuff is. It is an 84, and obviously the, I would say probably the most famous Flair Steamboat stuff is from 89. And so it doesn't quite have that, it doesn't have the juice or the fire of that feud behind it. And maybe they were feuding at this point, but I don't think it would be on the level of 89. Few things are. And so I think maybe that takes a little bit away from it. I don't know. It's a hard match to kind of sit here and break down because it is very long, but it is very good at the same time. It's just kind of, I guess it feels weird because I'm kind of saying that the things that are bad about it, maybe it's because I feel like the things that are good about it are probably obvious with these two guys. And that this, I think they're two, and why I think they work so well is that they're both such instinctual wrestlers. And that both Flair and Steamboat, I think they just kind of know when to ebb and flow at a match and when to pick things up and slow it down. Like, they're just so good at these things. And I think that comes through, and it's why they can carry an hour-long match like this. And I think, to me, that's the biggest strength of this match. And we'll get more into the other ones later on why I like those a bit better. But it's really awesome. I mean, I'm not going to take anything away from it. Obviously, I have it ranked number 16. But I do think of a lot of the all-time Steamboat Flair matches, I do have it kind of in the lower tier, and as we're going to get to as we continue our rankings. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this? I don't know. For some reason, this is a hard match for me to talk about.
This is kind of a hard match to recap because I didn't have as many notes as I often have because you can't sit and do a great detail on a match this long. So I had it 38, and I think we're close on ranking it in the pantheon of Flair Steamboat matches, I guess. I think we're kind of in slotted about the same spot there. And those two are just, they're so great, it's really hard to rank all their matches because, you know, you have a 4.5-star match and kind of be like, yeah, okay, I mean, that's not as good as they get other times, but you never see anything that I don't think is kind of great if you watch it in a vacuum. So I saw a match they had in Japan that was before this time, and I thought, well, that's a 4.5-star match. So I just think that those two could meet in a hotel bar, you know, or meet in an airport bar, and hey, there's 4.5 stars right there, you know. So and what I would love is, because the announcers always reference that they had a feud over the U.S. title, and I think Steamboat won it from Flair. I think that was sometime in the 70s, and I would love to see that. I haven't heard of any of that footage. Maybe somebody. This match finished number 31 on the total list, and Chad covered on Carolina Dreamin', and he kind of noted the headline, and in a way, I thought that made some of the early part a little slow. This payoff in the end is the counter. Obviously, like you mentioned, 60-minute draw. They were both baby faces. And I thought that was interesting things in the match because they would show frustration at times. But neither one ever fully turned heel. Flair hits a baby player. I mean, you know, Flair can hit low blows and still be a baby face. He doesn't go. I mean, I just assume that Ric Flair walks around and every once in a while he would randomly be walking down the street and he nut shot someone. I don't know if that's right or not, but I'm Steamboat, you know, he goes to the top with about 3 seconds left to make the countdown, but I had that in my notes. I'm not sure why. I guess obviously not going to get thin there. You know, it was still tremendous wrestling, tremendous storytelling in the 60-minute time frame. So, and I think you made a good note that these few people may do that. All right. So that would move us on to my number 15, which is Vader versus Sting in Starrcade 1992. I believe we will talk about that just a bit later.
Yes, it will be very soon, don't worry. But so we'll go to my number 15. My number 15 will be, so as we get into this last stretch too, I think we're going to come back to a few feuds a couple times, and this is going to be one of them. It will not be the last time we talk about them. So this is going to be, and this may be controversial because the way I have these ranked, we just started the Flair Steamboat. So my number 15 is Flair versus Luger for the world title from Starrcade 1988. It is a extremely famous match. What I think would probably be consensus considered like Luger's greatest match ever. I think if you just kind of poll people and average it out, like, do you have offhand how this finished in the final list, Tyler?
I do. Match number 21. And I believe this also received a number one vote. So.
Not surprising. It is awesome. It's not my favorite of them, but it is still great. I love the chemistry between these two guys. It is just so good. Like with Flair, just him against like a big powerhouse, like Luger, it's just constantly like not knowing what the hell to do. It's kind of like, and it's amazing. And the way the kind of cat and mouse thing that they do, where it's just like, you know, Luger's just going after him, whipping his ass. Flair doesn't know what to do. He's begging off. He's trying to stall, doing everything he can. And just, and you know, not any kind of new thought, but Luger in this era is just really awesome. Like, he's such a stud. His offense is so varied compared to, I think, what people would think of him later in his career, where he kind of didn't do a whole lot, maybe. I think here he kind of pulls out all this stuff. He can work very quick. He can kind of go along with Flair's pace, and then you get into, of course, Flair working the knee, and it works so well. It's kind of like the Flair thing, but what he's doing with Luger, it just works so well because it just makes so much sense, and it's kind of cool to see him, I guess, this big powerhouse babyface. It's kind of similar to sort of how he works with Sting, but I feel like it works better with Luger for whatever reason. I don't know why, maybe because Luger kind of tosses him around a little bit more. I don't know, but it's kind of a similar dynamic that he has with Sting, but with Luger, for whatever reason, it works a little bit better. But he kind of goes after the knee, and that kind of becomes the story of the match. And it's just, it's just Luger going after him and beating his ass and like hit him with these power moves. And then Flair just having to do like he does all the time, getting desperate, you know, going after the knee. And then they kind of work that into the match where it's towards the end, Luger finally gets the torture rack on him. And you almost know that Flair just knows he has to survive long enough, because it's almost like Flair knows, I've been beating his knee for so long, there's no way he can hold me up long enough. And so it's like you could see Flair just kind of holding out. And of course, eventually Luger's knee just buckles. And then he ends up falling on him, and he gets the win that way. So it kind of just brings a full circle. And so it's like his strategy won, you know. And it's kind of like we talked about the Vader match, even though the roles are reversed there. But to me, it's kind of like a much better version of that, where he has to face somebody who's much more powerful than him. And so he has to work the knee. It's just the finish to this one is a lot better. But anyway, it's just him surviving. Luger's just such a great house of fire in this match. He's so aggressive against Flair. They just have off the charts chemistry. There's no other way I can really say it. Now, I know it's controversial because a lot of people say Luger probably should have won right here, but if you're just judging it by the match, I think it works okay, because the storytelling is so well and how they get to the finish with the knee buckling, I think is okay. I think maybe in the grand scheme of things, there's probably some credence to that, I would say, but that's not really the purpose of the list. But yeah, this is a fantastic match. It won't be the last time I'll talk about these two guys, but they're just, oh man. I know we keep saying this with so many pairs of teams and guys, but it's just, I don't know, it's just the story of this. It's just, there's so many great pairings throughout the history of, you know, WCW and NWA and like Jim Crockett, that it's kind of just, you kind of just go back to it. It's just, there's just these pairings of guys that just work so well together. And when you put them together, especially on like a big stage like this, it's just magic. And this is an example of it.
I
think you had it.
100% agree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I had it 35. So I had it 35. And I think this is an example. Anyone who thinks Booker is not a good worker, watch this match. And I agree with you that this is not my favorite Ric Flair Lex Luger match. We got another one we're going to talk about, although not on this very night, which means it is indeed in rare air. But this match is great. I also, since we're talking about Lex Luger, I feel like I want to give a shout out to some of your cohorts on PTB NXT, Jennifer Smith and Jim Capel. Did a top in WCW on Lex Luger. And I think they start to kind of come around on Lex a little bit, or at least see some of the positives. And I'm definitely one of those that thinks that Lex is bad. Oh, 87 to about 90, maybe early 91 is just tremendous. I think he's a great worker during that time. And this match is a really good example of that. He's got great power and charisma, and that gets him over in the shine. I think he's really good at no-selling, which sounds like a very odd thing to say, but when he does it, it kind of makes sense. It's not that he is making his opponent look bad. It's just, you know, you've done a chop. Well, that doesn't bother me because, you know, look at my pecs, look at my titties bounce. I don't care, you know. And he's, you know, he's got the physique to do that. A legit badass, at least in terms of the body. You know, I don't know what he is in real life, but he portrays that well, I think. And I agree with you. I like the finish. I like the work, and it comes into play in this match because so often, you know, Ric Flair will do that for the bulk of the match, and it doesn't really come into play. But here, it does because, you know, he buckles on the torture rack. So I just thought it was a tremendous babyface performance from Luger. Makes him look like $1 million in defeat, like he does. And I also had a note that I wish I could grow a mustache like Tony Schiavone. So that's where I'm
at. Don't we all?
Yeah. Okay. So I believe that takes us to my number 14, which is Ric Flair versus Ron Garvin in the cage on Worldwide that aired 10/3/87. So I will head up that way. And this is kind of another one of those matchups, at least in my mind, that, you know, just you can just keep going back to. It's one of those things that they always are just gold together. So this match finished at number 51 on the total number list. Each match Flair's title in Detroit. And I feel like the best Flair opponent that just gets over the fact that he's just not going to take any of Flair's shit. You know, he's just not going to. And as usual, these two just beat the piss out of each other. And I think Garvin does that, or I think that happened more in this one than in any of their other matches. David Crockett sounds like he's not going to make it about 5 minutes in. So, this is a really fast pace. It winds up being a very long match. So, you know, kudos to them. Garvin gets a lot of offense, and he slaps Flair in the corner a few times. Not like his hard slap chops, but just kind of disrespectful, almost playful, like you would, like if a older kid was doing it to a younger kid, just kind of a slap. And I actually slapped my own face on that, so since I'll let you in, peek behind the curtain on that.
Getting into
and hopefully I won't knock myself out or anything, so I'm not gonna emulate their chops or their punches. So Flair's working the arm about 15 minutes in, which is a little unusual for him. What's not unusual is that he uses the ropes for additional leverage whenever possible for some nice heel heat, but cheap heat. So Garvin breaks with headbutts, and he gets a figure four. and they stay in it for a while. And then he holds a half crab, and like it's too much action to call, but I feel like it's really compelling. Like they just know how to get you in. And then Flair eventually gets a figure four, and he shockingly used the ropes. I'm shocked as you are. And he works the leg some more. Garvin counters the figure four into a small. A little later, Garvin counters hands a stone, but he's a little slow to cover, so he doesn't get the win. Garvin ran her into the fence, which the announcers call it a fence, and that seems to happen often here in WCW, and it sounds odd because obviously the WWE would ever. So, in a big surprise, Flair bleeds, and he tries to escape, but Garvin knocks him off and hits crossbody for a nice near fall. Flair does a flop after just no move at all. He's just, it's kind of a stalemate. He does a Flair flop at somewhere between 25 and 30 minutes. But I thought that was kind of a nice touch because it kind of sells that exhaustion, like they've really been going at it. Crowd is into this. And I'm concerned that David Crockett may have a stroke at this point. Garvin hits the Garvin stomp, and he's still selling the leg, by the way, from the figure four. They're working on the leg. So, a tremendous job there. Garvin starts to go for an elbow, just a standing elbow, but tries to roll away a little quick. So Garvin hadn't dropped down yet, so he doesn't miss it. And he goes right with Flair and then drops the elbow. And I thought that was just a really cool spot. That's the sort of thing that makes it look real. It's still real to me, damn it. And that's the reason why. So Flair's in the cage, but he gets knocked off. And Flair falls. But Garvin stays on the top rope. And he hits the sunset lift. The baby faces fill the ring. The crowd loves it, at least. And at one point, Crockett said that you're watching the greatest. And that's a bit of an exaggeration. It's not number one on my list, and it wasn't number one on your list, but it's total hyperbole for an announcer to say. And, you know, I just felt like these guys really kept the crowd interested, and that interest kind of built throughout the match.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's cool. This one's a good bit longer than a lot of their other ones, and I don't think it hurts the match at all. Like, I don't think it's too long or anything. I think it gives them more time to establish with the. It's kind of like the standard story with these two guys is that it's always like Flair kind of thinks he's too good, but then he gets in the ring with Garvin and realizes Garvin's like a tough bastard, and like he's not just gonna like sit there and chop him because if he chops him, then Garvin's gonna chop him back harder. So he always has to find something else to do to try and fight him off. And in this case, because I think we had talked about one earlier on our list or on one of our lists where that match where I think it was from a year or two before this, like in 85. Yes, yeah, at December 85, the great episode of TV. But that's when they almost start this whole dynamic even back then where it's kind of like I was like, well, who's Ron Garvin? Who cares about this guy? And he gets in the ring with him, and it's like he always forgets that Ron Garvin's like a tough son of a bitch, and so he always gets taken off guard. And it's always a cool dynamic to see, like him just trying to figure out what the hell he's gonna do. But in this case, Garvin actually ends up winning, and it's a really cool moment to see Garvin kind of grind it out and get the win in this one. It's awesome stuff. I enjoy it. We've talked about it before. They have great chemistry. You kind of laid it out. In this match, why it works so well. But, yeah, it's good stuff. I'm glad we have multiple Flair Garvins on our list because I think they deserve it. It's always they're a great pairing. As I've said, that a lot of this is – it really comes down to, especially as you get into the real top part of the list, it's really a lot of coming back to these great matchups. And I think we're going to have a lot of repeats as we – not repeat matchups, obviously, but just repeats of the same guys being paired together because – there's just these great feuds and great pairings of guys who have such excellent chemistry. But with
absolutely. I think that's a good transition to your next match. Cause I think it might have a really good pairing as well.
Yes, one that we're going to talk about a few times. So we'll start it off with this one. It won't be the last time, but this would be Vader Sting from Starrcade 1992. This is the King of Cable final. And so actually kind of it's weird to talk about in this because you would think if you were just talking about him, you'd probably go in order. But for the purpose of this, we have to go by the ones that we rank. So this is kind of like the middle match of their I guess like in the middle of their sort of feud from 92 into 93. I really love, like I said, so this one is for the King of Cable tournament. Sting, I think, is really awesome in this one because we haven't talked about the match that happens before this where Vader beats him, but it's kind of, you really get a sense, and I think it's why the thing, the real strength of this one is that by this point, Sting is kind of accustomed to Vader and he kind of knows what to expect and he kind of knows he's going to go in there and get punched in the head a bunch, like get clubbed a bunch, and so he knows he's gonna have to take it, so he kind of goes in with that mindset, and it's awesome to see him kind of fight through it. And like he kind of has these and I think it's one of his strengths, we talked about Sting before in these lists, is that he's really awesome when he kind of fires up in his sort of hope spots. And I think it's like a masterful job of it in this one, like he's just taking these sick punches, like Vader's just clubbing him in the head and he just won't back down from him. And every single time he kind of fights through and gets a little bit of offense in here, like at one point he gets like Vader's clubbing him and he moves in and gets like a little back suplex on him. Like the crowd's just eating it up. And the more he fights through it, the more the crowd gets behind him. It just builds and builds through throughout the entire match. And like it all makes sense. Like his selling in this is awesome. Like to me, Vader, you know, Vader's going to Vader. But I think of all these, Sting really puts in a great performance here. He's great in all of them, but for whatever reason, he stood out to me in this one. Like just the way he, is selling in this, like when he's getting, when he's getting knocked around, he kind of just flails around, like he's just constantly stumbling, but he's trying to stay on his feet. Like I said, he just really does a great job of getting across in this one that, like, he knows what to expect from Vader. He knows how, like, he's going to have to get his ass kicked. He just has to survive. Like, I love the part where he's in the corner and he's just getting clubbed. And he's almost, like, asking him for more on commentary. It's like, he's not backing down. He's not backing down. It's just, like, an amazing moment when you see that he's finally going to, you know, he's not going to give in to Vader. And he actually wins this one, which is a really cool moment. And it tells a great story of him. Kind of, you know, he's been there with Vader where he just basically gotten his ass kicked and now he kind of knows what to expect. He fights through and he's able to actually win the finish is cool too because Vader's kind of going off the top rope and Sting catches him and hits him with a power slam and ends up getting the win. But yeah, fantastic. I think one of Sting's greatest performances, honestly, is in this match, just all-time face performance. As far as being, we'll talk about another sort of a different sort of Sting performance against Vader later on. But this one, I think it's, he just does such a great job of sort of doing the babyface comeback and surviving, kind of similar to what we talked about with the Flair Vader match. But I actually think Sting even pulls it off even better. And I think it's just a little bit more of a crisper match. And I think Sting's power helps him against Vader because it's believable because he's not a little guy. He's just little compared to Vader. That he's able to pull off these kind of back suplexes and that he would be able to kind of slam Vader, even though it's a struggle, he can't do it like it's nothing, like he can with a lot of guys, but it kind of, I think it helps the dynamic of it because it makes him, like his arsenal is a little more varied than maybe like a Flair against Vader. And so it makes for, I sound like a broken record, but just great chemistry. They just work so well because Sting is a power guy, but against Vader, it's like he has to really struggle to be able to use his power, which is cool. So I'll let you talk, Tyler, because we were basically, as close as we could be on this one. I was 14 and you were 15.
Yes. This match finished number 13 on the voter list. You had it 14 and I had it 15. So that's a nice symmetry going there, 13. Although I guess we're both a little low on the match. I thought it was 13 and we were at 14 and 15. But this is about as close as we have gotten. And there's a few times where we wind up within one spot of each other, and this is one of those. So, and both guys wrestled earlier in the urethral lottery here, Battle Bowl, and I'm giving that as a credit to the UCW as I mentioned earlier. So that's a great show on the Legacy TV wrestling feed. So I believe that was Greg that coined those terms. So it's remarkable to have a good match with those limitations for the my thoughts were yours, Jake. Yeah. Sting just really looks like a fighting hero in this series of matches, and this one in particular. At one point, the announcers talk about how Sting's been playing rope-a-dope, and Invader kind of works for a little bit. It looks like it's going to be successful, and then Sting kind of gets distracted by Harley, kind of like a moron, which Sting will do from time to time. But then it leads right into that finish, which I agree was great. And I think that Sting did do a little bit more, like babyface Sean, you'd mentioned. He did a somersault kick that winds up kicking Vader in the head, and that's not something you see Sting do a lot. But, you know, I thought he did some good things like that. And he does sell that exhaustion. Vader tried to superplex, and Sting just, he fought him off, but then he just kind of falls off the ropes. So I agree that this is one of the things stronger performances here. So.
Yeah, it's great. We'll talk more about him in a minute.
Well, and that is where we go. My number 13 is Sting versus Vader in the White Castle of Fear strap match. We will not talk about that right now because you have that a little higher, and we'll talk about it very soon.
Just a smidge. Yeah, so I'll go on to my number 13. So my number 13 would be Ric Flair and Arn Anderson versus the Hollywood Blondes from Clash of the Champions, I believe 23, if I'm not mistaken. And so this is in the midst of the where the Hollywood Blondes are kind of trolling the Four Horsemen with the flair for the old stuff. And I forget what they say something about Arn. I can't remember the line that they give to Arn, but they rag on Arn about being old or whatever. And so this is kind of the culmination of that. They're fighting for the titles. It's 2 out of 3 falls. They really push this as sort of a feud as the 80s versus the 90s, this whole feud between the Blondes and the Horsemen. Of course, the Horsemen are awesome, but we haven't had a chance to talk too much about the Hollywood Blondes. I think we talked about them maybe once or twice, but they are in full like Hollywood Blondes mode here. They're awesome. They're super cocky because they're the champs here. It's really awesome. So we kind of start off with the Four Horsemen really sticking it to them, which I thought is a fitting start. You have the cocky young heels coming in, and they just sort of get schooled by Flair and Arn to start off with. And Flair ends up grabbing the first fall. But and there's just a lot of cool spots. You know, like I said, this first part is really almost like the Blondes getting caught off guard, like their cockiness getting the best of them, because they really just get hammered in this first fall. Like there's a cool spot where Austin, like he survives something, and so he starts taunting him, doing the like rolling the camera thing that the Hollywood Blondes thing, and just Arn just takes him right into a DDT while he's still rolling the camera. So a lot of cool spots right there, just them kind of getting their comeuppance. But then they sort of switch it in the second fall, where then Flair's starting to get worked over. They really, it's like the Blondes sort of get serious and realize they need to step it up, and they really start doing some really awesome teamwork to go after Flair here, which is really great. And they actually end up getting the fall too. Here, Arn comes in. You get the I call it the Arn Zaguri, because Arn actually hits an Enziguri at one point in this match, which is kind of incredible to think about. But they really like the dissection on Arn's knee is almost like Flair-like, which I thought was a good little touch to have. You know, Austin going after Arn's knee almost like he would be Flair. It's really vicious and awesome. And I just love the way the Blondes kind of escalate things, how they're getting their ass kicked in the beginning, and they kind of show that they're not all talk as it gets into the second part of the match. And so they actually get a fall off of Arn. But then the third fall, they're really building it up really well. Like, everything is really good. The only weakness to this match, I don't like. I love the way these two teams work together. I love the dynamic of kind of like the veterans versus the cocky young guys. It's like a heel face dynamic. Obviously, everybody in this match is super talented. The only thing I don't like is just the finish. Like, I think this match, as high as I have it, could be even better. And maybe I'm overranking and not penalizing it enough for the finish. But the finish is really deflating because it is such, you know, the first two falls are so hot and they're kind of building up in the end, you know, like who's going to get the third fall. And then Barry Windham just kind of runs in and just kind of comes in and locks in the figure four and it just kind of ends the match. And so it's just kind of a lazy finish. Like, even if they weren't going to have one team go over clean, I would have liked to seen it be, you know, I would at least like to see it be a little more creative than him just blatantly running in for the DQ. Like, it's just kind of deflating for how good the feud is and how good the match was that they were building to that. So I still, like I said, I could be overrating it and maybe not penalizing it up, but I just loved everything they did going up to the finish. It was just so damn good. I love it. Like, just the Blondes. I'm a huge Blondes fan. The Horsemen. It was just, oh, man, they were hitting on... They're hitting on all cylinders. The finish is just a little wonky.
Yeah, I agree with all of that, and we'll hit a lot of those points as well. This match finished number 74 on the total list. I had it at 53, so higher than the voters and lower than you who were near the beginning, and so what I thought was kind of a cool spot, Arn kind of holds up the stop sign and just tags him in before they've done much, and then he just runs wild on Austin. The Blondes turn the tide with some towel choking on Arn and do all the heel tag stuff and towel based offense, as you might PTB and XT, Jake. And I had that Flair has some big face energy on the apron. So it's really kind of nice. Flair working as a baby face. And Arn, too, because you mentioned he gets his knee clipped just before making the hot tag, and then Flair gets up first fall. But Arn's knees still hurt in that second fall. So Flair and Pillman kind of start, but it's good to see Arn, it's really interesting to me to see Arn selling that knee, and it's neat to see the Blondes working the knee. Arn collapses on an Irish whip, which I just love. Like, I love that kind of attention to detail, and I would expect Arn. I made a note on the Instagram, I do not recall seeing that much. One question I have, I don't recall the Blondes winning in the second fall. I thought that the second fall, I thought the first one won two straight falls, and then the DQ, which meant that, and the ending has been a problem for me. I've always hated the finish, just varying degrees of hatred. Like, when I first saw it, I was just like, oh my gosh, I just can't believe they're doing that. And then I think I came to accept it more because this project, they had a lot of BS finishes. So that's really not even my issue now. It's more like, it doesn't really do anything. It doesn't really advance much. The Blondes didn't do anything. If they had, like, intentionally gotten disqualified to save their title, or, you know, been trying to cheat and just got caught, thought they could get away with it and got caught, I'd have running out at complete random. You know, he didn't have anything to do with the match or anything. He wasn't aligned with the Blondes. And I know that was kind of the start of some of his issues with Flair, but I just felt like that was kind of weak. I don't know. And it's disappointing because the work in it was so great beforehand. You know?
Yeah, you're right. They don't
interesting get the second.
Yeah, the run is on the second fall. I was mistaken. Maybe I was fantasy booking because I wish it would have been better, because I would like to see, because I guess it's another detriment. It kind of makes the Blondes look a little bit weak in that they lost the first fall and then, you know, they have to get bailed out basically because the ending is like he's, you know, the controversy is, well, was he tapping or was it, you know, that's the whole thing. So it's kind of screwy. Yeah. So I'm with you. Like I said, I may be overrating it by not, I may be like hand waving the finish a little bit because I like everything else before it.
And I mean, I think that's valid. It's great that if these teams are great and they work great together, and you know, I would have loved to see either of these teams be dominant for the rest of 93 to 94, or even just compete with each other. But alas, none of that happened. I mean, I was kind of a Blair Arne break. But
all right, as far as heavy what hitter.
We got, oh yeah, my number 12 is Roddy Piper versus Greg Valentine in the dog collar match at Starrcade 1983. So we have already talked about this match or this combination of guys, I guess, but we'll talk about them again in this famous match. It really kind of got the concept of Starrcade off to a pretty heavy hitting start, I think. So this match finished at number 9 on the total voter list. And you know, I think this plays off of the match that we talked about earlier. It was set up by the Charlotte House Show match and other matches they had before that, I think, because I'm not even sure. I think the year psychology was kind of already in place by that Charlotte House Show match we talked about. They start kind of leaning away from each other, making the chain taut, and then Piper just kind of pulls it in like a tug of war, and then he nails Valentine with the chain, and Valentine tries the same, but he misses. Piper gets shine with the chain based off. When Valentine takes over, he goes right for that ear with the chain. And then he wraps the chain around Piper's side. So that's a great visual. Pretty soon Piper takes control, and he puts the chain around Donald's mouth, which is, again, that's brutal vision. And then he wraps the chain around the post and uses the leverage to kind of hold Greg in the corner. So he can, Valentine's bleeding, and then he goes back to Piper's hand. Piper comes with equilibrium, and he's stumbling around and like swinging wildly, and it's just great. Piper makes a mad charge for the comeback, still showing that his equilibrium is being fucked. Both guys are bleeding, and they're really getting across this hatred and violence, which we talked about in the match we talked about earlier tonight. These guys are just really outstanding at it. Valentine's side is covered in blood, and I'm not sure if it's his blood or Piper's blood. So it's kind of that kind of match. You can't tell whose blood's on different people. Greg hits the sleeper, which it really makes sense in the context of this match. There's blood loss. There's the equilibrium. Piper breaks that up with a chain, and Piper winds up winning by pulling Valentine off the top rope with the chain and then just wailing on. He kind of gets on top of him and beating on him like a schoolyard bully would, but with the chain. And he wraps the chain around Valentine's legs for the pan. I did finish came both a little out of nowhere, and that's what inspires me. That's like kind of the ultimate in nitpicking, I think. But yeah, it's just a great job of getting over the intensity, the hatred, and so this is an all-timer for me, no doubt.
Yeah, it's basically everything we said. I said about the match earlier between these two, just with the dog collar involved. So it's even, you know, you had that part of it with the brutality. It's just another brutal war for WCW. And I'm about to talk about another one because the next one I have is the strap match between Vader and Sting from Super Brawl 3. So which we have basically right next to each other again. So we're pretty locked in on these Sting and Vader matches, Tyler. We're like one away from each other each time. So we must be in similar thoughts. But yeah, it's a lot of what I said earlier about Sting and Vader, just generally the chemistry they have. But this one, you obviously have the strap, which is, I mean, to their credit, is a weird stipulation to work. I think it could very easily get real weird and be hard to pull off. But I think they do a really good job. Like I said, just another brutal match. There's just so many good, kind of sloppy in a good way, like spots to sell the brutality, like where like Sting gets hit, he's just kind of flying all over because like he's in pain. But the man, the image that always leaves me from this match is just Vader's back. Like after Sting's done whipping him, they show Vader gets up and you just see blood, like just blood smeared all over his back, and you're just like, holy shit, is he bleeding? Because like, is he bleeding from the strap? Like, that is, like, you're expecting, like, you know, like, welts and stuff. But when you see he's actually bleeding, you're just like, holy shit, this is, like, insane. Like, these guys are just beating the piss out of you. It's almost like Sting's, like, Vader was like, look, I know I've been beating the piss out of you in these matches, like, clubbing in the face. So why don't you give me some good ones on the back? Like, it's fine. Like, I'm basically at the physique of a walrus, so it won't hurt me that bad, you know? Like, so, so much cool stuff in here. Like the ref spot in this match is really well done too, where the they have a ref bump and Sting is just about to get to the fourth corner and he trips over the ref. So it's a cool, you know, because you wouldn't think maybe the, I guess the obvious thing would have the ref not see it, but to actually have the ref become like an obstacle, I thought was kind of a creative move to put in there. It's just, and the whole match just has this really cool dynamic because you're just wondering like, how in the blue hell could Sting possibly win this? How is he going to drag this like behemoth with him to these four corners? And like throughout the entire match, he tries his damnedest, like carrying him around. At one point, he tries to do it on the outside, but it's just he eventually succumbs to it. But it's a really awesome, another great performance by him of just being able to sell that he has any shot of this, that he's going to try his best. And it's believable because he is sort of a power guy that he could get this burst of energy and kind of lift Vader up and try and drag him around. It's just, he can't quite get it. He almost gets it with the ref spot, but just, they just do so many great little things. Like whether it's Vader's, like his brutality, like his little things, like the punches and everything he lays in, but just, and then Sting's desperation. Like there's a part where Vader's going to hit the Vader bomb, and instead of just doing the normal like move out the way a little bit, it's like Sting actually dives towards him, towards the corner. I thought it was just, it's a small thing, but it's so different, because normally you just think the guy would just roll out the way casually. But he does this kind of desperation, like almost like a roll sort of dive to the corner and just narrowly avoids. It's almost like Vader almost hits his feet because he's just barely getting out the way. So it's just cool little details like that just really get the dynamic of it over. But it kind of makes sense that Vader would win this one. But this one is probably like the most brutal of all their matches. And I think probably one of the best strap matches you're ever going to see, if not the greatest. So it's weird, kind of a similar thing as the dog collar match. It's kind of funny we talked about those two back to back because they're, I think, very similar matches in a way.
Yes, I would agree. I thought it was the most violent of their matches, and that's why it was the highest ranked of their matches for me. And it is similar to the dog collar match, with the one exception being that in the dog collar match, they didn't have the touch the four corners stipulation, which to me, at least, usually it's not kills the match, hurts it a lot. And it didn't in this one. Like I'm positive it's the best strap match that I've ever seen. And I can only think of two others that I feel like were very good. And that was the Eddie Guerrero JBL one. And then that, there was one in Smoky Mountain with Tracy Smothers and Dirty White Boy that was just a little bit before this match. So I think that was considered the greatest strap match for maybe a month until this happens. This match was finished at number 12 on the overall list. So, Jake, you really got your finger on the pulse of the voters, matching them here. I'm one spot lower, which is shameful, of course. So,
unacceptable.
It is unacceptable. I'll try to make amends in some way. And I had that Vader controlled early and even hits this really early splash, but Sting is able to regain control by using the strap to crotch Vader in the solar plexus. and then he fires up, and I'm not going to go blow by blow, but I had to get the solar plexus line in, and I did note that Sting whips Vader much to the delight of a wrestling granny and her daughter or niece or some relation anyway that's probably a wrestling granny today, or at least would be if WCW was still around. At one point, Vader hits the splash, and Tenay says that's 450 down. And for just a moment, I thought he meant that it was a 450 splash. And I thought, my God, can you imagine Vader hitting a 450 splash? So he's pretty athletic, but I don't think I see that one happening. You know, and this match just seemed like they keep hitting spots that I think is going to kill one of them, usually Sting. And then they top it. Like, they keep thinking, God, that's going to, he's going to die. And then they do something a little bit more. And then they do something a little bit more. At one point, Sting also, he gets Vader outside and he goes around the outside of the ring and touches, I think, three posts. And I thought that was a really innovative spot. And at one point, Nick Patrick stops Vader from further killing Sting. And Jesse says, hey, you know, if Vader wants to beat Sting up, that's his prerogative. And so then I'm singing in my head Vader's prerogative to the tune of my prerogative. So if anyone has new lyrics to that, go ahead and send them in. So but other than that, you know, I think that I think you hit a lot of the things, you know, with Sting really fighting back. And I like the finish that Sting looked like a real badass putting Vader on his shoulders, you know, and walking around. And he kind of bumped Patrick. And I had that he tripped over his worthless ass on the way to the fourth corner. And Harley kind of rolled Patrick into Sting's leg, I think. I think that was something that was supposed to be.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It wasn't quite as clear as I think it was supposed to be. And Vader was a bloody mess, too, bleeding from his ear. And of course, the straps on his back, like you mentioned. It was just, you know, I guess it was, I don't know, it was just shy of 5 stars for me. But I wouldn't argue that wants to go that far with this one. It's fantastic. Fantastic, brutal brawl.
No doubt.
All right. Does that take us to my number 11, I believe?
Mm-hmm.
Which is Ric Flair, Barry Windham, Sid Vicious, and Larry Zbysko versus Brian Pillman, Sting, Scott Steiner, and Rick Steiner in War Games from Wrestle War 1991. So this match finished as number 11 on the overall list. So once again, I matched the final vote with my finger on the pulse of PTBN, which is, I'm glad I redeemed myself from my previous unacceptable low rating on the previous match. So, but I do have to apologize because I think earlier in our podcasting road, I think I said that 94 was the best 4-man War Games, which was obviously an oopsie on my part because it's this match. So Windham starts and Pillman immediately breaks away and starts to get revenge on Barry the Horseman for injuring his shoulder the night before. And I like that because the rest of the face team, I don't think they didn't know he was going to do that. And the commentary, JR and Dusty kind of say that they acted like that. They thought the Sting and the Steiners wanted to protect him. They didn't want him getting in there early, you know, because he was injured. But he just, you know, went right after the heels here. And, you know, I think Pillman has maybe the best opening performance in War Games. And JR and Dusty are just putting him over hard. He is spitting fire during his shine. And Windham is bleeding almost immediately. Flair's in next. That, you know, the heels shockingly won the coin toss. I couldn't believe it myself, but apparently it was legit. There's a cool chop battle between Flair and Pillman before the numbers game takes over. And Pillman's just bumping his ass off. Wyndham's bleeding buckets. The horsemen are attacking Pillman's shoulder until Sting comes in to run wild. Pillman has Barry in the figure four, and then Larry Zbyszko comes in. He's greeted by Sting just flying from one ring to the other for a clothesline. The horsemen regain control eventually because the numbers game again until Rick's in for the Steiner lines for everybody. Flair goes into the cage and he's bleeding now. And I know that's pretty shocking that Ric Flair would bleed in a match. And Sid's in last for the horsemen. Wyndham's still working Pillman's shoulder, which is kind of the story of the match, but which is just in the Brian Pillman show. Flair's a bloody, disgusting mess, and Scott enters to kind of start the match beyond. And it's just awesome payoff. Sting puts Flair in the Scorpion deathlock. Tons of brawling. Sid hits a hammerlock on Pillman and fires back the punches. Sid rams Pillman into the post, and he unwraps the tape from the shoulders. The faces all get figure fours, and Sting gorilla presses Flair to the top of the cage. This has this kind of moment where it's at all the best War Games matches have. There's just this chaos, constant action, but it's just impossible to tell what's going on. There's so much. I think JR is doing a fantastic job calling all the action. And Pillman's just giving a star turn babyface performance, I think. I mean, it's just his show. He's doing a great job. And until Sid damn near kills him, power bombing him, but Pillman's feet kind of hit the cage, so he gets dropped just right on his head. An incredibly gross spot. And Sid, being the professional he is, he power bombs him again. El Gigante comes down and throws him in the towel. And then Nick Patrick does a promo saying that Pillman was unconscious, so he couldn't speak for himself. I don't love the Deontay bullshit, but otherwise perfect. I mean, I think that him carrying Pillman off, it doesn't make him look great, but
no, he looks like a baby, just, like a small child being carried off by his giant. I like that. Just real quick, I love that despite being in none of the actual matches, Giante is like snuck into these podcasts a couple times some kind of way, because he's always like, during this period they were just trying to shoehorn him into stuff to try and like make him a thing, and so we have all these weird matches like the Sting match, the Sting Flair match, this match where he just randomly pops up even though he's not in the match. It's just, it's kind of funny that Giante has found his way into the greatest match ever list somehow.
Exactly. Yeah, it's shocking that his own matches didn't make it. And I bet even during the watch, as I was watching most everything, I didn't see very many Giante matches. Cause, you know, I think they were just like, yeah, he's really tall. We can't put him in the ring, but anyway.
Oh, yeah. God. They couldn't have put him in this War Games match because he would have hit the ceiling. The ceiling's so low.
Yeah. And I've never been clear on if this was the planned finish. And, like, it happened close to how it was supposed to happen. But, like, the power bomb was a botch, man. Fucked that up. You know? And so I don't feel like I've ever gotten a good answer. Like, if that was what was supposed to happen, except not drop him on his head completely, or if, as soon as they saw that powerbomb, I'm like, oh, holy shit, get him out of there. We got to stop this. I mean, it's kind of interesting in that the heels win and it doesn't feel like complete bullshit. And, you know, I mean, it was a great match before that. So I do think, you know, Pillman looks like such a star, and to this day, I do not understand how WCW repeatedly fucked up making Pillman into a star. They had multiple chances, though I think this would be the best one, and they either couldn't or wouldn't pull the trigger. But I've been so impressed with Pillman, you know, going through this project and watching it, and I thought this was just one of his best matches ever. So, and I know that, you know, you were really high on this match. We were basically in the same spot here. You had it, you know, tonight. So I think it was at 16.
Yeah, and I had roughly the same thing as you. It was really a coming out party for Pillman, especially at the beginning, like you covered it. Like him just throwing Barry around, and to Barry's credit, but Barry's bumping his ass off as usual, like flying. Like there's a spot, I think, where he throws him from one ring to the other, like in the middle part, and Barry just kind of like flops and ping pongs over the ropes. Like, so he's making him look like $1 million. So he looks great in that. And I definitely think it was something they were shooting for. And I wonder if him getting like hurt at the end of this, I don't know what the story is. It'd be an interesting thing to look up in the Observer or something to see if there's anything about this. Cause you're right. It is a strange finish. It definitely seems like the plan was for Giante to throw in the towel, but who knows how much it got kind of screwed up, and like maybe they just sent him out there once they seen that, you know, Pillman might have broken his neck. But then why have Giante hold him up, like carry him around like a small child? But so that whole thing is weird. But like you said, really, I think a lot of these War Games matches, it comes down to the teams too. And I think you have two stacked teams. Like Sid, even though he does have the botch, like he's almost made for War Games because he's just such, he has such a chaotic energy, and he's such a giant, like to just go in there and throw people around. It's cool to see the Steiners in War Games. I thought they were a cool addition to the face team. Like we said, Sting's always good in there. And then Pillman just having this kind of, you know, this breakout performance was really cool. And then, of course, your heels are all great guys, too. You get, like you said, it just insane energy from top to bottom, balls to the wall. You get the four-figure four spot in there at one point. It's just, like you said, it just kind of captures that that it gets to a level that very few – that, you know, that War Games is built on. It's like the more you can capture it, the better you have. And the more you can capture that kind of chaos and – like you said, where that moment in the match we'll talk about later on the next episode, maybe, well, definitely the best example of that ever. But they do a good job of this where you just have that, where they kind of cut the camera. You just see guys flying all over the ring and just you can't even see what's happening. It's just like a mass of humanity and blood and sweat and craziness going on. It's just, it's really awesome stuff. So I think this is a good example of it. I think I kind of wish maybe we get a little bit better finish, but it's a small nitpicky thing. And I agree with you. It's a credit to Pillman with the guys he's in there with that this, he was kind of the standout performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess you talking about Sid, that kind of led me to think, we give him a lot of shit, but he's a pretty tall guy. And that cage was pretty, you know, that was pretty low. You know, he's what, 6'9" or 6'10"?
Yeah, and like I feel like I feel like his head is almost hitting the roof. Like I feel like if like Sid could not have raised his arm up straight up in the air without going to the top of the cage. So yeah, I think you're, you know, to give Sid a little bit of credit or a little bit of a break, it maybe was a bit of a failure by design. Maybe that cage should have been a couple feet higher considering, you know, who we have in there. And just, you know, I guess they're kind of going for the, they wanted to feel like confined, because at this point, I don't think they're really thinking of it as something like, or they're going to have guys climbing on the top of it or anything. Like, that's not really their deal. So I guess they were maybe looking to make it just seem claustrophobic was maybe their thing. But, yeah, I guess not the best decision for, you know, Brian Pillman's neck in the end.
Well, they – every War Games match, they have somebody doing a gorilla press, you know, into the top of it. So you might think somebody might think of that, but what the hell do I know? So, in fairness, I've never been a professional wrestler. I just using logic and reason. So
yeah. Never built a cage either. So who knows?
True. All right. On to your number 11, Doug. Take us home.
Yeah. So my number 11 would be Ric Flair versus Barry Windham from January of 87, which we'll have as a cliffhanger because you have it a smidge higher. So, spoiler, it's going to be in your top 10.
I do. It will be on our final episode for a countdown, our top 10. We're getting close there, Jake.
I know. One more. 10 more matches. And I think this next one, our last one, will be the one where you have – we're, it could be our most, how do I say this? Like our most linked up we've been. like the most that we both have. I think, you know, we've kind of been far off on some of them and close to some, but from the looks of it, I think our top 10s are pretty close. I think it'll be one of the closer episodes we have as far as us both having matches pretty closely ranked to each other. So it'll be a fun one for sure. Yeah, and obviously we'll talk about some,
you know,
some epic matches. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. I think we've both had our own things and matches we loved, and there were a lot where we both had them. We might have had them. We might have had them spread on them. And I think that some of the differences we had, you know, allowed us to talk about more matches. I think that's a good thing. So I think that's good for the listeners, assuming we have any. So, but you know, by the top 10, we all kind of come back together. You know, we all kind of converge on some of these all-timers that, like, you know, we're a lot of the usual suspects, but, you know, we confirmed that, yeah, those matches are still great.
Absolutely. You have anything you want to plug, Todd, before we get out of here?
The only thing, I guess, would be the Facebook page for the greatest WCW wrestler ever. That is ongoing this year. We've released all the results of the greatest WCW match that, you know, we're covering here. If you haven't seen those, you can find those on Place to Be Nation. You might have to do a search to find them in the archives. But that's about all I have. I guess I would just give a shout out to all the great content on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, the North-South Connection, and the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Jenny Position, which I believe that I hit four of those, and that is the squad of pods, the pod fathers that Cristolo talks about. So I think I've done my due diligence there. That's
yes,
all I've got.
The quad of pods. I'll quickly plug a newer show that I'm doing besides the one that I've kind of all the ones my regulars is I just started doing we're calling it YouTube Roulette, and it may appeal to anyone who did, you know, who's willing to go look up these kind of somewhat obscure matches for the GWCW project. And what it is myself, Logan, Scott Chifflett, and Sean Kidd, once a month we're gonna find I want to say four matches from YouTube, where we're we'll rotate who's gonna pick, and we pick four random matches from YouTube, and we just live watch them and talk them out as we go. And it seems to be what we've kind of fallen into quickly. We have only one episode out. The next one we'll record soon. Is that I feel like this is gonna be a contest between the four of us to figure out how obscure and weird we can find it. And that seems to be where we're going. On the first episode, we watched a 42-minute Bob Orton, Tito Santana match from, what was it, like AWF from 1994 or something. So you can about imagine. We watched some Glow, some 80s Glow. We watched the Rockers in AWA. So we're really trying to find some really out there stuff to make it interesting. And kind of we're not watching beforehand, so you're kind of seeing our trying to find stuff we haven't watched before. So you're kind of getting our live reactions, which is kind of a fun thing to do. We kind of, you know, we BS around and do that whole thing. So it's a lot of fun. So check that one out. It's a newer one I've got going on.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. So check that out. But other than that, I guess that wraps up our 20 through 11. Thanks anyone for listening, and please come back as on the next episode. We're going to wrap this thing up. We're going to get through the top 10 and probably get through some final thoughts on our list. And it's been quite a journey, Tyler. I'm looking forward to close this out and getting to talk about our top 10s with this.
I agree. It has been quite a journey, Jake.
All right. Well, until then, I'm Jake, and for Tyler, this has been episode 9 of the GWCW Countdown. We'll see you for the last and final episode. All right, that's it. One, you're like a dream come true. Two, just want to be with you. Three, girl, it's plain to see that you're the only one for me. One through three, I make you fall in love with me. If ever I believe my word is
Once you know.